This is Still Standing with Michael Caputo, episode 57. Coming up on today's show, Biden burning and watch your back. All that and more on the way on Still Standing.
No talking points, no spin. It's politics you can't put down. This is Still Standing with Michael Caputo.
Hey, hi, it's Michael Caputo. Thanks for listening to Still Standing. I appreciate your time. I know you have precious little of it. We all do. And I know if you're listening to my podcast, you probably listen to other podcasts. And I appreciate you spending your time on the treadmill or in the car or your time alone listening to my voice drone on. I really appreciate it. The podcast has been growing now, especially in recent weeks, and I really do appreciate the folks spending time listening to it. I'm actually just in a pretty average, maybe a little above average political consultant. I've been involved in almost 80 different political campaigns, sometimes as campaign manager, sometimes as communications director, more often as a communications director or spokesman, but also as a strategist, a media buyer, ad designer, writer. It goes on and on and on. I've been doing this for a long, long time. And so I guess I first started my first campaign was when I got out of the Army in 1983. I volunteered on Ronald Reagan's campaign for re-election in the 1984 cycle. And, it just kept going from there. And so the quadrennial, the presidential contest, is something that I pay very close attention to, not just because I'm involved with Donald Trump. My involvement in politics started long before I met Donald Trump. Well, actually, only 5 years before I met Donald Trump. I'm in my late 50s now. I met Trump in 88. My first campaign was 83, 84. And I'll tell you, the Iowa caucuses are something to me that always, first of all, I couldn't understand why these people did it this way, this, gathering up in the caucuses. Actually, when we vote in the primaries in New York or in Florida or in Texas or Virginia, all the states I've lived in, you go in, you vote, you leave. In Iowa, people actually show up and spend hours voting by, standing alongside the people that support the same candidate they do. And if their candidate does not remain viable after the first head count of these different groups in the gymnasium, then your candidate's not viable. You go on to another candidate, one of the top three. To me, when I was there in the 1988 caucuses for the Republican Party, for Jack Kemp, I thought it was odd. I also thought it was really interesting, in a lot of ways, very beautiful in a Democratic Republic kind of way. Every state does their political party presidential nomination a little bit differently. Most of them do primaries. A few do caucuses. I think one of the Dakotas does a caucus. But the Iowa caucuses are the first in the nation. They've always, certainly in the last half a century, led off the entire presidential campaign cycle, even though they start campaigning earlier and earlier now. Seems like as soon as the presidential campaign is over, as soon as the election is over, the new candidates start campaigning for the next cycle 4 years later. And I guess that's part of the deal, especially when you have such a vast nation as America and a broad electoral landscape. There's a lot of work to do in order to make yourself a viable candidate for president. But the caucuses, they're odd. Neat, odd. I remember in 1988, I was out there going, I was with Jack Kemp. That was when the religious right really came out. They came out to elect Ronald Reagan, especially in 84, but they were out in 80 as well. But so in 88, all the presidential candidates thought that they could out-Reagan Reagan or be a bit of a Reagan themselves and attract some of the the born-again vote, some of the religious vote, the evangelical vote. And we actually, as Republicans, factored them in from there forward. After Ronald Reagan, we all believed that the evangelical vote was an important part of our coalition. It waxed and it waned, but in 88, it was in full force. Everyone was courting the evangelical vote. And I remember being at a church in Iowa where Jack Kemp and other candidates were speaking, including Pat Robertson, who was the one who truly invigorated the Republican leanings of the evangelical crowd. And I remember going outside. My job was to round up some volunteers. I was director of the writers group for Kemp for President. But when you were in Iowa or you were in New Hampshire, or you were in a Super Tuesday state, you were an organizer. You were a grassroots organizer. So I might have been a communications person, but I was out organizing volunteers to put flyers under the windshield wipers of cars in the church parking lots and other places where Jack was speaking. It was really actually an 88, I guess I was 26. It was a real honor to be able to do this. Coming from a little town outside of Buffalo, New York, I never thought I'd be involved in the Iowa caucuses. Well, of course, my congressman was running for president, the congressman of the South Towns of Buffalo, Jack Kemp, was very popular in the late 80s, a hand-picked leader picked by Ronald Reagan. Brilliant guy, a lot of fun to work for, also very difficult to work for. But I remember walking out into the parking lot of this church in the frigid winter of Iowa, just days before the Iowa caucuses, and I caught supporters, I suspected, and pretty much confirmed, supporters of Pat Robertson were putting flyers underneath the windshield wipers like I was going to. We were putting out pro-Kemp with pictures of Jack and his wife Joanne and the family, the girls and the boys, on the flyer. And there's this guy putting a flyer under a car windshield wiper. And it was a flyer insulting Jack's daughters. And I won't even go into what it said. It was very personal. And I just blew my stack. Jennifer and Judith were friends of mine. I had a big crush on Jennifer, I think, back in those days. I think everybody had a crush on Jennifer and Judith. They're just great people. And all of us single in those days. And they were in and out of the office working hard for their dad. And all of us took great pride in working with the Kemp family. And when I found this flyer insulting Jennifer and Judith, I just threw down with this guy in the parking lot. He and I got into a fist fight. And he wasn't much of a fighter. I had, you know, spent time in the military, grew up in a rough neighborhood. I wiped the parking lot with the guy. And then I promptly went around and took all of his flyers out from under the windshield wipers. There are hundreds of cars, so I'm putting mine under, taking his out. The Iowa caucuses are intense, but they're not complicated. I guess they're complicated. There are 1,700 locations where there are caucuses, where people go stand in the corner with their, you know, under their candidate sign. Each one of those candidate signs has a coordinator organizing that group. That's 1,700 coordinators at least for any candidate who's in it to win it. 1,700 at least, and usually more than one at a larger location in Des Moines or one of the other towns where there's a lot of caucus activity. Universities usually had younger people. Churches or church gymnasiums usually had older people. But it was intense, but it was very... It didn't seem technology-driven. You know, obviously, you're counting heads. They're actually counting noses. At the caucus that I was tasked to in West Des Moines, they were around. They counted noses. That's how they described it. I think that was unique. Maybe it wasn't. But it was interesting to see them take, you know, count noses for all the candidates in the race. And then they took the top, I guess, three. And then everybody that was one of the candidates that wasn't one of the top three went and took their nose to another candidate. And they counted those. And that ended up part of the algorithm that selects delegates, state delegates. Wasn't really a big deal. I remember our Iowa caucus was, the results were in pretty early. I remember because I got done drinking at midnight that night, and I had drank a lot. So we must have had an announcement in the, in the evening. And so to see the Iowa caucuses go off the rails like this, two things. Number one, it feels like history has basically passed judgment on Iowa, and they will no longer be trusted to hold the first in the nation selection of presidential candidates, number one. Number two, I'm very suspicious. It's not that difficult to do the count of the Iowa caucuses. But before I get into why I think it's suspicious, let's talk for a minute about the Iowa poll. There are pollsters in Iowa because every four-year cycle, people there get wealthy. There are political consultants who actually take money to endorse, and political figures who actually take money to endorse. They're hired by campaigns. They endorse them. They get their paycheck, and they attend a few rallies, and they're bought. People in Iowa know that, especially the activists who are close to the political apparatus of the Republican or the Democratic Party. They know there are people there that are bought. It's untoward, but they're actually working. The Iowa poll comes out on the weekend before the caucuses. It's done by one of the local pollsters. The one today has been around, I guess, doing it for well over a decade. And one of the news organizations usually partners up with them, one of the TV news organizations, a radio news organization, and they always partner up with the Des Moines Register. It's, some people call it the Des Moines Register poll. Others call it the Iowa poll. It's the final measure, public measure of where these candidates stand. Never before have I heard of any problem with the Iowa poll, ever. And this year, they canceled it. At the last minute, there were people in the crowd on the set at CNN who was a partner in the Iowa poll this year, along with the Des Moines Register. They canceled it as they were warming up the cameras to do the TV special. Canceled it. Everybody's scrambling, right? Now, polling's expensive, but any candidate who's competitive in Iowa is doing some sort of tracking poll. They know what their numbers look like. They know what they're going to, how they feel they're going to do, but they want to see what the Iowa poll says. They use it as some kind of a public polling benchmark. So they say, well, there's a 3-point spread on us in this county with the poll. Let's send a couple more staffers there. Let's send some additional materials there, additional yard signs, put more resources in counties where we feel good, but the Iowa poll says we're not. Or, other breakdowns. The Iowa poll also drives spending in New Hampshire. It doesn't seem likely when you first think about it, but as you know, as they're waiting for the Iowa results, they're already making commitments for spending on TV and elsewise in New Hampshire, and the Iowa poll either makes them feel better or worse about their plan, and they change it. And sometimes the Iowa poll drives millions of dollars worth of spending one way or another in New Hampshire and onward, but really in New Hampshire. So when they canceled the Iowa poll, I thought, that's strange. They canceled because some person who supported Pete Buttigieg got a call and said that he didn't hear Pete's name. Well, meaning that the person who was reading the question to him didn't see Pete's name. There was some explanation that the polling telephone caller had the character size of the questionnaire blown up on their laptop, and Pete was on the bottom. Don't know why. His name begins with B, right? But Pete Buttigieg didn't come up on the screen. They didn't read it. And so there was all kinds of angst over how people would react to one caller accusing them of not having Pete Buttigieg on the questionnaire. And they just flat canceled it. Let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that stinks. There are several. I'm not a pollster. I know a lot of pollsters. I've paid a lot of pollsters in my life. Gosh, I probably spent $1 million on pollsters across 30 years. No pollster I've ever met would have told me to pull the plug on the whole show. There's no way that they would have done that under any circumstances. Now, certainly not these circumstances. They'd have pulled the plug for something else, a massive data meltdown. But for one respondent saying they didn't hear Pete Buttigieg's name, no way. Not possible. They pulled the plug on that poll after they knew the results. And of course, when the results came out later on, mostly from a Twitter personality and actually lawyer, media commentator, author, Mike Cernovich, a controversial guy in some quarters, a guy I really respect. Most of the people I know respect him. And Mike went out there with the poll numbers showing that Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders were on top and that Joe Biden was in fourth. And suddenly they pulled the plug on it because of one respondent complaining about a name missing. Why would you pull a poll when the complainer is from the winner of the poll or one of the winners of the poll, certainly in the margin of error? If Pete Buttigieg's supporter said, I never heard his name, and Pete Buttigieg won the poll, would you complain? That's like, do you actually take, you know, you accept the penalty or decline the penalty? You know, you've just scored a touchdown. Somebody on the defense held on the play. You take, what do you, they think we're idiots, people. The Iowa poll set everyone on edge. It showed that Bernie was in the thick of it. And Bernie is either winning or neck and neck with Pete Buttigieg in Iowa. Joe Biden was there by himself, practically him and Pete. You know, the other candidates, including Bernie, were stuck in Washington on the impeachment. Ladies and gentlemen, they pulled the plug on the Iowa poll because it embarrassed Joe Biden. It showed Joe Biden down hard. It showed Joe Biden, as he called it later, with a gut punch. But he didn't call it a gut punch until days and days later. The big deal out of Iowa isn't just who won, but the Iowa's impact on New Hampshire. The bump, that's what they call it. When you win a previous caucus or primary, it gives you a bump in the next primary. It gives you a little push. And people say, well, if he won Iowa, he can win New Hampshire and he can move on and be, I'm going to go with a winner. There was no winner when people were making that call. Now, just as I watched the president's speech the other day, it was, and I will talk about that later, Perez, Chairman Perez of the Democratic National Committee, said, that's it. I've had it. Now we're going to go for an entire re-canvas of the Iowa results. Not only did the Iowa straw poll get completely trashed, even though Cernovich and others released the numbers, and we know now that Buttigieg and Sanders were far out ahead of a failed Joe Biden campaign, not only did they block the poll, they blocked the results that, by the way, almost mirror matched the poll. The poor pollster who was eaten up in this manipulation of the results of that poor woman. I feel badly for her. I actually beat her up pretty badly the day after the caucuses. Still suspicious that somebody had done something, that somebody had pulled the plug. I mean, in the end, that poll is paid for by people who are Democrats, whether you believe the Des Moines Register Democrats or the CNN. When they saw the results of them, this is terrible for Joe Biden. That means a socialist is on his way, likely, to become the nominee of our party. If Bernie Sanders gets a bump out of this, or you know, Pete Buttigieg for that matter, Joe Biden goes down in flames in New Hampshire. If we can just delay the results, you know, kill the results of the poll, delay the results of the Iowa caucuses, maybe they can announce the results by the time it's too late for anybody to get a bump. Nobody got the Iowa bump in New Hampshire. Pete Buttigieg, smartly, wisely, declared victory the next day and moved on. I think Buttigieg understood that he was getting screwed by this. And they're blaming his person for complaining. See, you had to believe that Buttigieg was one of the people they're trying to screw. right? So you cancel the release of the poll, meaning canceling all kinds of millions of dollars worth of advertising at CNN, by the way. For them to accept that means that they were either convinced it was flawed or part of the scam. And then they delay the release of the results of the Iowa caucuses. And just when they're about to release nigh on 95%, the chairman of the Democratic Party, Tom Perez, from Buffalo, by the way, Tom Perez, we got to do a whole entire re-canvas. That means, ladies and gentlemen, they're not going to have results, true results, that someone can bank on until the New Hampshire primary. You understand what they've done. They have erased the results of the Iowa caucuses. They have erased the impact of millions of dollars in spending. Millions and millions and millions. Now, they're blaming an app for failing during the Iowa caucuses. I worked on the 2012 presidential campaign doing Get Out the Vote in suburban Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. I had a handheld that was given to me by the Romney campaign, the former Republican Mitt Romney, that absolutely crashed. An app on that phone crashed completely. The technology that the Romney team and the RNC bought for the 2012 Get Out the Vote operation blew out in the first couple of minutes of the election day and didn't work the rest of the day. We stood there in the parking lot not having addresses or names or telephone numbers for anyone, and bus after bus after bus of Obama supporters came in. Now, nowadays, don't you look back on 2012, by the way. After 2016, all the screaming and ranting and raving about computer hacking and everything, do you wonder if anybody from the Obama effort hacked the Romney app? Just an aside. But for God's sake, everybody in Iowa knew the story of the national meltdown of the Romney app, and yet they put all their faith in an app. My understanding is they spent about $60,000, $70,000 on the app and didn't really pay for maintenance. You can't really make this up, although I do think some of it is made up. They canceled the Iowa straw poll, ladies and gentlemen, because Joe Biden lost. And Bernie Sanders won or was in the margin of error with Buttigieg. And then they dragged their feet on the results of the Iowa caucuses because Sanders and Buttigieg knocked Joe Biden's block off. Joe Biden was supposed to win this. Remember when he was on top of everybody? He's lost Iowa, ladies and gentlemen. Lost it. He's about to lose New Hampshire. And, honest to God, we've seen this whole thing before with Biden. We can pretty much predict what's going to happen next. You know, he's not going to do well in New Hampshire, even though they tried to blunt the damage by canceling the poll and dragging out the announcement of the real results. They've taken the bump away from Buttigieg and Sanders and went back and forth. He won. This guy won. Oh, it's nip and tuck. They just eliminated the Iowa bump. And not sure what they can do with New Hampshire. It's a primary. They're not going to be able to mess with it like they did with Iowa, but maybe they will. You know, election fraud comes in many forms. But now, let's say Joe Biden does what as many people now expect, and he doesn't do well in New Hampshire. I don't think he will. Then he goes off to Super Tuesday, in South Carolina especially, where he supposedly has a stronghold, and does he do well there after losing Iowa and New Hampshire? Let's just say this. Nobody has ever come in fourth in the Iowa caucuses and become the nominee of the party. So Joe Biden knows that fact. And he's been through this before. Let me tell you, I told you a story about the Iowa caucuses in the 1988 cycle. When I was in Iowa in the winter, I guess that was probably December of 1987, month and a half before the caucuses, Joe Biden was already out of the race. He had been out for months. And I remember that expressly. It's an interesting lesson for us to learn about Joe Biden, and I'll tell you this real quick before we go to a quick break. I was on Jack Kemp's 1988 presidential campaign. I was the head of Jack Kemp's writers group. I was a kid, you know, 25, 26, had already been in the Army infantry, just graduated from college, and proud as hell to work at Jack Kemp's presidential headquarters as the head of his writers group. It was a real honor. And Joe Biden and the rest of the candidates entertained us. They did. I mean, we had, remember, Gary Hart and all the, you know, Dukakis. There were so many interesting cartoonish moments on the Democrat side of the 1988 presidential primary that we put up, you know, the front covers of the National Enquirer, the Sun, New York Post, New York Daily News. These front covers of these tabloids cover the presidential elections like nobody else does, right? The New York Post covers after each of the different crazy things that have happened in 2016 have been funny. If you looked at the one that came out after Nancy Pelosi ripped the president's speech up after the State of the Union, it was hilarious. I think it said, you know, they're always funny. So we would actually cut them off the front of the newspaper and pin them to the wall. And we had so many funny covers during the race that it covered one entire wall. All the way around, it started going on to a second wall. I was in there with Herb Terry, Lindsay Lloyd. What a great guy. Those guys were awesome, you know. John Rand over in press office, Nancy Kemp over in finance. Gosh, all these great people. You know, Mark Berry in the press office. All these guys, they'd come in, they'd hang out in the writer's room in the Kemp for President office in 1988. And actually, we were all smoking in the office in those days. They'd come in my office to smoke. And we had covers of Joe Biden up there too, because if you remember, Joe Biden got in trouble in the 1988 race. He fell out of the race really fast in the fall of 1987. You see, Biden gave a speech or said something at an August 23rd Iowa debate, and he plagiarized a British member of parliament named Neil Kinnock. You probably don't remember. You're probably too young. A week after that happened, because nobody noticed, his opponent in the race, one of his opponents, Mike Dukakis, the governor of Massachusetts, who would eventually become the nominee, his people circulated a VHS tape of the two men speaking side by side, Biden and Kinnock, and it was uncannily word for word. Uncannily, it was very clearly plagiarized. We got a copy of the tape. We watched it in the Kemp office. It was damning. So we saw it right after a story broke on, I think it was September 12th, the New York Times and the Des Moines Register. Everything breaks on the Des Moines Register in Iowa during the caucuses. When that story broke, I remember it like it was yesterday. I had been in charge of the writers group, and we had this, they called it the playpen, where all of us would, we have a lot of, spitballs going around, writers harassing each other, because there were probably 7 or 8 workstations in there, as well as the IT people. And it was the lowest of the low, not a window, internal office. And we're all smoking in there. You can imagine how awful it was, the playpen. And Jack Kemp would come in, and he would stick his head in and say hello. He'd never come in for very long because he hated cigarette smoke. But that day he came in and he looked at our wall. All the tabloid covers, and he saw that we had just put one up from the New York Post. I think it was a day or two after Biden's plagiarism charge, maybe the day after. And it was on the New York Post or Daily News or something. And he pointed around the room and he said, "Go ahead and laugh, fellas, but you better be darn sure you never do this to me." So what Jack Kemp thought, he thought Joe Biden got screwed by his writers, and that really blew my mind that day. But let me tell you something. I was careful checking everybody's work. You know, there wasn't software in those days to discover if something was plagiarized. Whoever put this together, this plagiarism accusation against Biden, had stumbled onto something big. It really blew my mind that Jack thought it was his writer's fault. But as we, as we watch Biden, that bonfire burn down in the media every day from the 12th of November. I just remember these dates. September 12th, the New York Times story, Des Moines Register story, blew him out of the water. He's scrambling. And then we find out that another story leaked to the media that he had failed a Syracuse law school class back in the 60s for plagiarism. And again, another story came out, you know, the drip, 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 just like Kavanaugh. Democrats have been doing this forever. Republicans, too. We found out that Biden had plagiarized Bobby Kennedy, of all people, in a February 87 speech in front of the California Democratic Party. So after I knew about these two other plagiarism accusations, not just accusations, flat out instances, I knew this was Biden's fault, Biden's crime. I can't imagine somebody in his campaign didn't say, my God, Joe, you really shouldn't steal Neil Kinnock's lines here. You can't just read his speech. Why are you reading Bobby Kennedy's speech? You don't say that. It's like saying to Joe Biden, why is Hunter Biden working at Burisma? Why is he making $5 million at Burisma, Joe? Don't you control U.S. policy to Ukraine and billions of dollars that are going to his company? Nobody said that to Joe Biden, just like they didn't say you shouldn't read Neil Kinnock's or Bobby Kennedy's speeches. You can't say that to Joe Biden. I tell you, he held I guess 5 days after, yeah, like the 17th of September, he held a press conference in the United States Capitol to try and control the flame out. I went to it. Our Jack Kemp's campaign headquarters wasn't far away. I went over there and attended it. I wanted to. I just never seen a press conference like this. I knew it was going to be hard to get in, but I got in. It was the best crisis communications lesson I ever learned, ever. And I've been through a lot of crises. I've applied these lessons that I learned at each one that comes after the other. But I remember I stood there knowing that he was completely flaming out of the race. I knew he was done. You could smell it in the air. I could hear panic in his voice. And the reporters I knew who were in the room, they could hear it too. They were like, eesh, you know, that clenched teeth look. Ooh, this is hurting. 5 days later, Joe Biden dropped out and actually shocked everybody. He just kind of said, like, screw it, I'm out. So, I mean, it was just such a precipitous fall and such a sudden dropout. Jack Kemp, anybody else would have tried to stick it out a little longer. Probably Joe Biden wouldn't have survived it, but it'd even stick around 5 days. So some of the lessons I would say we learned from the Biden's 1987 flameout can help us understand what's going to happen to Joe Biden in 2020. He's going to address these campaign failures head on in a press conference, or maybe two. He'll have a come to Jesus press conference after New Hampshire. If they don't mess with the results, he'll be making excuses or saying, we've got a firewall built in South Carolina. South Carolina firewall. But we'll hear panic in his voice in New Hampshire the day after. We'll hear panic in his voice at his concession speech. And of course, when he drops out, it'll be sudden, like that. We'll think, Jesus, that's fast. What the hell did he do? He's got money left. He'll drop out just precipitously. Bam, he's gone. Sabotaged by a Democratic competitor, of course. And, you know, like Mike Dukakis, that candidate's going to deny it as well. I think that candidate's going to be Michael Bloomberg. I think Bloomberg during the Super Tuesday, March 3rd, the run up to March 3rd, he's going to drop Hunter Biden stuff on Joe Biden. I think those are killer shots. I think that if Joe Biden doesn't get out after New Hampshire, Mike Bloomberg is going to blow him away with a Hunter Biden shot. That's what's going to happen. No other Democrat would dare do it because that's against Democratic orthodoxy. But Michael Bloomberg doesn't give a damn what the DNC thinks. Does not care. He owns them, as you see. He gave, what, $400,000 to them? And lo and behold, he's in the debate. I think it's amazing, but it's true. He now owns the Democratic Party. I don't know. Mike could probably... Bloomberg probably would, he'd probably deny it. He's a liar to his core. And he'll deny that he did it, but he's gonna launch an attack that'll wipe out Joe Biden. We're all gonna be really surprised at how rapidly he drops out and then tries to completely drop out of sight. Watch. Boy, in 1987, he just disappeared completely after he dropped out. It was like, where's Waldo? He'll try that again, but of course he's gonna have a problem with that this time because there's that little thing of these Ukraine investigations and Burisma and Hunter. He's got to tend to that because it's not stopping. It's not stopping. These Ukraine investigations are going forward. Senate is definitely going to do something. And God bless it if the Department of Justice doesn't do something in the end. They're certainly predicate enough to do it. If they don't do something, then we do not have rule of law in this country. Joe Biden is going to be tied up with Ukrainian investigations, congressional and criminal. I know a little bit about that. I just wrote a book about it called The Ukraine Hoax. I just finished a documentary film about that called The Ukraine Hoax. You can buy them both at theukrainehoax.com. The book is coming out soon, so I'll be going on a publicity tour, doing all the media and stuff when it does come out. The book, The Ukraine Hoax, is about, you know, decades of corruption that led to Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, basically pocketing $5 million worth of money, and probably more. You see, you listen to Dan Bongino's podcast. If you don't, you should. He's advancing this story every day. Rudy Giuliani, God bless him, advancing this story every day. I don't care what the left says. Rudy Giuliani is a godsend. Dan Bongino gets crap all the time. He's advancing this story. This whole Ukraine thing's blowing apart, and Joe Biden's stuck in the middle of it.
Still Standing. Still Standing will be right back with Michael Caputo.
Hi, welcome back to Still Standing with Michael Caputo. I appreciate it. Thanks for sticking around. This is slowly growing. I appreciate all your support. I got all the emails and texts and such when I had taken a break to finish my film and my book, and it made me realize that this is something I need to continue. And you are an important part of it. You really are, especially the folks who are what we call our executive producers, the people who work hard. You know, in their whole daily lives and decide to spend a little bit of money on our show. They do it via patreon.com. And if you look at Patreon, you can actually pick up our podcast at patreon.com. But if you go to Patreon and want to give us, you know, a couple of bucks a month or whatever you think it's worth, if you're getting four or five of these a month, we give special deals to them as well. We're going to be the people who have signed up for our podcast will get special deals on my film and book coming up. We call these folks who support us our executive producers, like Stephen Flaminio. Hi, Stephen. Thank you very much, man. Brian Mangus. Thank you, Brian. These guys are new, along with Harrison Stockton. These guys just came on board. I got to tell you, I feel blessed to have your support. Like our executive producer, John Seifert, Henry Wotazik, Susan Havey, Thomas Fulton, Sonia Carlin, Samantha Lynn, Brian Pesdersky, Jack Bromwich, Julie, Jordan Gostomsky, Susan Stevens. Is that the Susan Stevens I know from college? I guess it's not an unpopular name, but it could be. Patty Freeling, Bill Grant, Mark Berry, my old pal Mark Berry from Jack Kemp's press office, press secretary, Gary Stokes, Scott McRae, Catherine Barzicki, Frank Butry, and Brent Sheehan. If you wonder why I have so many Polish people, people with Polish last names, supporting me at Patreon, that's because I come from Buffalo, New York. As Italian as I am, we are surrounded by Poles, and we are proud, proud of our Polish community here in Buffalo. We have parties every year after Easter. We have the greatest party in the world. Dingus Day, we call it. When I think it's girls run around with squirt guns and squirt boys, and boys run around with pussy willow branches and you know, tap the girls with them. Or it's the other way around. I don't know. I'm Italian. But boy, do we drink on Dingus Day in Buffalo. That's why I know how to pronounce Polish last names. If you don't know that in Buffalo, New York, you're nowhere. Nowhere. We really appreciate listener feedback via stillstandingpodcast.com. Craig Forney in Cedar Park, Texas, sent me an email. Excellent broadcast, one of the best, and there's a lot of good ones out there. That means a lot to me, Craig, because I listen to podcasts all the time, and I try and get hints. I love Dan Bongino's podcast. There are others I listen to, not necessarily in politics. Another email at stillstandingpodcast.com. Hi, Michael. I'm a Toronto WBEN 930 listener, and when you're on the air, I stop everything I'm doing to listen to you, and I also receive your podcast, which I enjoy very much listening to. I was listening to this morning, January 26, 2020, and you mentioned your new book, which I have been eagerly waiting for its release. I missed part of how one can order a signed copy from you. I'd appreciate if you could send me the info on how to order your book. Thank you, Michael. From Ron Ustenko, who sounds Ukrainian. Ron Ustenko, Toronto, Ontario. We love living on the border of Canada here in Buffalo. The people of Southern Ontario, Toronto, are part of our neighborhood. We cross, until recently, just popped across the border just for dinner. Chinese food in Fort Erie, Canada. The Niagara Falls side of the falls. And boy, oh boy, Toronto, what a great place to go. It's like living near New York City. Now, of course, because we're allowing illegal immigrants to get driver's licenses, all of our speed pass type, you know, enhanced licenses and all that stuff, it's all canceled now. All the federal government does not recognize our identity documents designed for efficient passage through the border, because Andrew Cuomo has decided to register to give a driver's license to illegal immigrants. It blows my mind. Blows my mind, but true. But anyway, that's some of the crosses we bear living in New York State. It's great to live. I live in a little town called East Aurora, the best place in the world to live, except for the taxes, the horrendous bureaucracy of this government. It's a terrible, terrible existence when you realize you're being led by idiots, like we are in Albany, much like we're led in Washington. And we have been for so many years. I don't care, Democrat or Republican, I haven't really seen much great government. I've seen good government, but not great government since the Reagan days. I've seen good government. But, you know, you look at the unemployment numbers again today, another great report, 200,000 plus jobs. Donald Trump is kicking serious ass. And I actually saw somebody say, we see the continued expansion, the continued Obama expansion, right? But I want you to understand something that we're about to endure. All of us. All of us. And I was called out for this on Twitter by an MSNBC, no, CNBC reporter. I'm unashamed, however, for what I said. What we're seeing right now is what we call classic rebound Donald Trump. This is how Donald Trump acts when he survives a beating and it's his turn to start throwing punches. Let's say he picks up the fumble and he's got the ball all the way to the end of the game. He's on a slow, long drive to the goal line to win this election in November 2020. He is not going to relinquish possession of this ball. It is not going to happen. Not going to happen. And you know this if you know Donald Trump, if you look, even if you don't know him and you just study his life, you understand that, like, for example, when he got beat up so bad in the casino business in Atlantic City as the economy turned down, he had just bet on the economy and unfortunately it didn't pay off. And he was having very serious difficulties in that business, and he was enduring bankruptcy, et cetera, et cetera. It's a terrible beating for any businessman, and it happens all the time. Bankruptcies happen in business a large percentage of the time. I don't know what the number is, but you know, most businesses, you know, close or go into bankruptcy in their first year. But I'll tell you what we're going into now is classic rebound Trump. he is going to beat them now. And he's going to beat them again. And he's going to beat them again and again and again and again. He's going to keep beating them over and over and over again until he can't beat them anymore. Classic rebound Donald Trump, just like he did when he came out of the casino business. He worked his butt off and just kept punching and did not give up until he rebuilt his business on a different model even. Beat them and beat them and beat them again and again and again until he can't beat them anymore. And he's going to do this and plan it and roll it out in a way that it lasts. And it takes him all the way until November 2020. And that's a good thing. That's a solid. I like the way Donald Trump does this, but it brings a certain reaction out of his opponents, whether it's business or politics, but certainly in politics. It makes people do crazy things. When now that he's got Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and Adam Schiff and all these freaks on the Democrat side who have been harassing him, presidential harassment, no doubt in my mind, for three whole years have not let him up, and they will. And now they've tried what the ultimate punch that they can throw is impeachment, and they finally threw it. And he is acquitted, exonerated completely. And we still, ladies and gentlemen, have 10 months left in this election cycle. They just lost their butts in Iowa. They blew it. They can't run a two-car funeral. And Donald Trump picks up a fumble? Oh. He's on a long drive to election day, ladies and gentlemen. And the lawless left, who lost yet again, now they're completely enraged and they're desperate. And unfortunately, violence is going to follow. I'm certain of it. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, although after 3 years of having the weaponized Obama national security apparatus trying to throw me in jail for nothing, the whole bogus Russia investigations that nearly bankrupted my family, I got to tell you, I don't believe that the federal government is looking out. I don't believe that the national security divisions of our country are legal and following procedures as they're supposed to. Look at what they did with the FISA warrants against Carter Page. They are criminals, all of them. That is not a conspiracy. But I do know this. Violence is going to follow now. Donald Trump is going to win. He's going to win again. He's going to win again. Remember when Donald Trump said, you're going to ask me, Mr. President, please, no more winning. We thought it was funny. He's going to keep winning so much that these leftists absolutely lose their mind and the violence is going to begin. I'm not kidding. Watch your back. Protect your families. Protect your businesses. Lock your doors. Set your alarms. Add more cameras. Carry your legal weapons, ladies and gentlemen. This is what's going down. They have tried everything with Donald Trump. And now he's going to continue with these Ukraine investigations. And this is serious business. People have been giving billions of dollars in foreign aid and washing it through companies and organizations in order to get paid on it. Hillary Clinton's largest donor base from any nation came from Ukraine. Something like $11 million. She put billions of dollars in foreign aid in Ukraine. Billions. She left before the Maidan massacre happened in February of 2014. Right after that comes in Joe Biden. Hillary Clinton's gone. All that grift is available. So what does Joe Biden do? He throws his son. He doesn't have a Clinton Foundation. He doesn't have an apparatus that can scoop up all that money. All he's got is Hunter Biden. He just got bounced out of the United States Navy for a coke problem. So he throws his cokehead son onto the board of directors of one of the most important companies in Ukraine, oil and gas. Don't forget that. Oil and gas is always at the middle of everything. He throws his son on the board of directors and his good buddy and business partner, Devin Archer, on one of the most corrupt companies in Ukraine. And then he delivers $3 billion in loan guarantees to energy companies. One of the biggest, I think the biggest recipient in the private sector in Ukraine of these loan guarantees was his son's boss, Mykola Zlochevsky. Donald Trump is not going to stop. He's not going to leave this on the table because he survived impeachment. He's not leaving it there. That's why my book is out right now. That's why my film is out right now. That's why Dan Bongino is blowing this up on every one of his podcasts. That's why Rudy Giuliani is blowing this up on every one of his media opportunities. Look at what the Blaze is doing. Everybody's focused on Ukraine. You know why? Because it's there. There is something there. Donald Trump was right. He's not going to give up, and the left is going to go crazy. Not because the anarchists want people like Joe Biden to make millions undisturbed from taxpayer money. No, no. Because the people who benefit from these billions of dollars, the people who benefit from it, like George Soros and others, billionaires, multinational billionaires, they're going to pay these protesters to do exactly what they did during the Kavanaugh selection. Remember when he was appointed and then confirmed by the United States Senate. It was restrained, violent protest. Restrained. Remember, they were chasing senators down the hallway, holding elevator doors open and screaming at them. The violence was restrained. They didn't get the green light. They didn't let their people pop off. But now they have nothing left. They still had impeachment in their quiver before. They had other opportunities to grab Trump, throw him down, throttle him, kick him out of office. But now they've got nothing. And all these people who are about to be exposed for ripping off the American government, this grift is going to get exposed, ladies and gentlemen, and the left is going to go nuts because they're going to be paid and inspired by billionaires that they are serving. These Antifa types, they all serve them. The Women's March, you know, partially paid for by George Soros and other billionaires. The Black Lives Matter protests, you know, the protests at the airports after Donald Trump was elected, trying to shut down the airports, all paid for by big money. Who pays for those buses bringing all those pink-hatted people into Washington, D.C.? Next time you see a large group of people, go to the buses, take down their license plate number, and find out who paid for it. Now, they're cloaking that stuff, but maybe they won't. All this stuff comes from billionaires. There is going to be violence. There is going to be violence. It is going to happen. We've seen it happen before. We've seen it happen in Ukraine. Watch your back. You have to understand how big this is. Right after the Maidan massacre in the central square of Ukraine in February of 2014, I talk about this a lot in my book, a little bit in my film, but a lot in my book. The Western nations that had been, you know, providing foreign aid to Ukraine had a meeting, you know, because after the massacre, the president, corrupt president of Ukraine, fled to Russia, and along with a bunch of oligarchs, including Hunter Biden's boss, right? A bunch of oligarchs ran with him because they thought they're going to get locked up for stealing all the money they stole, like Hunter Biden's boss did, right? Hunter Biden's boss served as Minister of Energy of Ukraine, right? And pretended he didn't own the largest gas company and then gave a bunch of gas leases to his own company, hiding behind fake ownership. He created the biggest natural gas company in Ukraine for himself while he was Minister of Energy. That's billions. So these Western Western aid analysts and Western government diplomats, all these feckless bureaucrats got together counting on their fingers and toes, had to take off their socks and their shoes so they could count high enough. And they figured out that $100 billion had been stolen out of Ukraine by oligarchs and corrupt politicians. $100 billion. Not all American, but a lot of it was American. $100 billion of this, I guess it was, what, since 94, the first presidency after the Soviet Union from 94 until 2014, $100 billion stolen. Ladies and gentlemen, the aid really ramped up in the latter part of that period. So I'd say most of that $100 million was stolen in 5 years. Where did that money go? I can tell you, it went through people like Hunter Biden. It went through people like Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump has figured this out. I know he figured it out. We talked about it in 2013. We talked about Ukraine in 2013, the president and I. He's known about this for a long, long time. And it isn't just Ukraine. Take a look at Guatemala. Ladies and gentlemen, it happens all over the place. It tends to be an emerging market, an emerging nation, a third world country, because that's who needs the money. That's where they can put $1 billion, and that's where they can bribe somebody to give some of that money back to you, to them. These, you know, multimillionaire politicians who go to Washington paupers. Donald Trump's going to expose that. The lawless left is enraged. They're going to get crazy, desperate. They're going to get violent. I'm not kidding around, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here to tell you, right here on stillstandingpodcast.com, right here, read my book, theukrainehoax.com. Watch my film. You can buy the film and the book there, theukrainehoax.com. I think the ebook is available on Amazon next week, theukrainehoax.com. You'll understand what I'm telling you. Recognize familiar faces. Recognize familiar tactics. Watch what happened in Serbia, Georgia, Ukraine, all the other what they call color revolutions. The only thing that happened there that hasn't happened in America is snipers on the rooftops shooting 100 people in 20 minutes like they did on the Maidan in Ukraine. Who paid for the snipers who killed those people? Because I know their money's green in America as well. Watch your back, my friends. Protect your families. Protect your businesses. Lock your doors. Set your alarms. Carry your legal weapons. You know, Thomas Jefferson once said, as one of my favorite quotations, I use it in the book and in the film, that it's much easier to get rid of wolves before they've made it into your camp. You keep them out. You kill them before they get in. It's much easier to get rid of them then, but when they're crawling up your leg, trying to bite your to tear your throat out. Ladies and gentlemen, it's too late for that. All those wolves, they're inside the camp now. You see them. They're Antifa, dressed in black. They're beating people up, innocent people on the street. You've seen the videos. Everybody's seen them. The only ones who won't talk about them are the left because they know what they're planning. They know what they're planning. Watch your back. Protect your family. Protect your business. Lock your doors. Set your alarms. Carry your legal weapons. Because this, ladies and gentlemen, this is just starting.